You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Welcome to the Open Society Foundations. Tonight, we have a pleasure of welcoming Fred Abrams, the author of Modern Albania, a book that we will be talking about tonight, not only a book, but also about the country. The modern Albania. My name is Beka Vuco. I'm the regional director for the Western Balkans, and Albania is one of the countries that I cover as well through my work. So I'm quite familiar with what has happened and what is happening at this moment. And I'm so glad to see you all here tonight in this great number. So it is my pleasure to welcome also Mr. Arjan Nair, President Emeritus of Open Society Foundation, who will introduce Fred tonight and start the conversation. And then we hope that we will have some questions from you as well through the question and answer session. So, Arjan, please.
It's a great pleasure to welcome Fred Abrahams here this evening to talk about his book, Modern Albania, From Dictatorship to Democracy in Europe. I think this book is one that belongs here at the Open Society Foundations. We feel a kinship to it in every way. Fred went to Albania in the first instance under the auspices of the foundations. His first job in Albania, I think, was at the media center established by the foundation in Albania. Throughout his work on Albania, we have kept in touch. We've also kept in touch when he has veered away from Albania to deal with other matters. To deal with other parts of the Balkans, such as the war in Kosovo, or even when he was diverted to Libya to undertake research there for Human Rights Watch. Most of Fred's career has been spent on the staff of Human Rights Watch, conducting research and writing reports for the organization. Fred has been one of the emergency researchers for Human Rights Watch. Those are the handful of researchers who deal with the most difficult situations and very often the most dangerous situations on behalf of Human Rights Watch and their ability to get the facts on various human rights violations and get it out fast and reliably has been crucial for the organization and often crucial for the protection of human rights. So as an admirer of the work of Fred and the other emergency researchers for Human Rights Watch, it's also a special pleasure to welcome him here this evening. Also, for me, it's a very great opportunity to refresh my own knowledge of Albania. In my early years with the foundation, I traveled to Albania very frequently. Because we had undertaken a particularly large project in Albania during that period. After that, I stopped going to Albania and went to other parts of the world more frequently. And so it's been a pleasure to read Fred's book and to get up to date in that way, and also to get up to date by listening to him this evening. So, Fred, it's all yours.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for coming. It's a bit like a wedding or something, a bar mitzvah, so many different parts of my life, so thank you. I hope you'll indulge me just for a moment, because this is the official, the launch, or the first public event of the book. So I feel not just obliged, but also deeply motivated and moved to just say a few thank yous. So if you'll just bear with me for a moment. the first goes to this esteemed institution. I began the research for this book with a fellowship, Open Society fellowship, many, many years ago. And of course, the money's good. You know, it helped and it allowed me to take trips, go to Albania and begin the research, and that's important. But beyond that, you know, it's the motivational push. When you start a project like this, by nature, a lonely endeavor to write a book, it's critical to know that someone thinks it's a good idea. And so that for me was far more important. So thank you, Arye, for that. And Gara LaMarche was the head of the fellowship program at the time, no longer with the Institute. And then the Balkans team, Becca Vucho, who you met tonight, Marina Pravdic, who's helped a great deal tonight, Jonas Rolet, and Laura Silber, who, hi, Peter. Great to see you, who I don't think is here tonight. And another person not here is Annette Labore, who was in Albania for many, many years for the foundation. So I'm deeply grateful for that support. And then there are a couple individuals here. Tani Puto, you may rise. Artan flew in from Tirana. He's a professor of history at the university. And really, by far, was the closest collaborator for this book. I don't know how many hours we spent in the bowels of the National Library going through dog-eared copies of Zeri e Popolit, the Voice of the People newspaper from 1989 and even before, talking to all the characters. And it's that kind of sounding board, you know, the person after you've just interviewed a ex-Politburo member or the head of the party for Tirana, you need somebody to look next to and say, all right, what'd you think? Let's hash this out. You know, Tani, thank you. 15 years, sorry. Yeah. It's like a third child. I don't know if he's here. He was supposed to come today. If he is, he doesn't have to stand up. But that's a dear old friend, Fran Nazi. Is Fran in the house? Where's the Naz? He doesn't have to stand. But actually, Fran has a connection to this institution, for those of you who don't know. He was the first director of the Soros Foundation in Tirana. Worked there when I first went in 93, I think 91 to 93, was his tenure. And really, I think no one more sort of lifted the curtain for me to peek behind and introduced me to a lot of people. If we spent many hours in the library, I don't know how many crates of wine and beer and probably cigarettes we went through, just hashing through you know, the events and the people, our mistakes, and trying to understand what went on. Mimbroma Shenasi. I'm grateful for that. And Fran always said, please just hold a mirror. Hold a mirror to us as a people, as a country, and help us to understand, to analyze and appreciate what we've gone through. I hope I've succeeded to do that. When he was one of the first people to read the book in the finished copy, and then he told me, it's good, you know, I like it. And for me, whatever reviews may or may not come, for me, that was by far the most important. So, Naz, respect. And then lastly, and I'll get on to topics of greater interest, are my two lovely parents. I can't say any more without making it, and all of their friends. Probably half the room are probably from your various school life or friends, but thank you. Yeah. Okay, but with that, I managed to hurdle that the difficult part. Now becomes the easier part to talk about this topic I feel dearly about. I just wanted to do two things and to do it fairly briefly so that we could have some conversation. One is the process of writing this book, and then the takeaways, a couple of the nuggets that I feel maybe I can conclude. First, on the process. For me, writing this book had two very distinct parts. There was heaven and there was hell. Heaven was sitting in the coffee shops of Tirana talking to all the protagonists, actors and actresses, the factors, the assets who played a role. From the ex-Politburo members to the Democratic Party founders to the journalists, the lawyers, the gangsters, and the spies. What a pleasure. And for me, a particular joy because I witnessed many of these events. I went there, as Arye said, in 93, covered it for Human Rights Watch, and was an observer of many of these moments. So I had the good fortune to return, sit down with characters, and ask them, what were you thinking when you did this? Why did you make this move? Where were you at that time? Why did this all happen? And to piece together this jigsaw puzzle. And, you know, of course, people spun their tales. Everybody had a line. But people were also sincere. They also took their time. And the book would have never happened without their contributions to it. So I'm deeply grateful for that. And then there's the source material. The library, the archives. I collected hundreds of Freedom of Information Act or submitted hundreds of Freedom of Information Act requests and got a lot of documents back from the State Department and even some of the CIA. You know, going through all of that was a real joy. As a side note, all of that material I'm posted on a website that we made for the book, the key documents, and the rest of the material is going to the Open Society archives in Budapest and also the National Security Archives in Washington so that students and scholars and journalists and others can benefit from this material and may it be used. All of that was a pleasure. Horrible was putting it together into some coherent narrative. You know, I knew I had pearls. Albania produces pearls, if you didn't know, metaphorically speaking. But how to connect them all on a string and tell a story? And you know, what are the key points we want to take away from this period of transition? Who are the main characters that played a role, and why is it important to talk about them? And making this all into something that's, you know, marginally interesting. You know, the best story poorly told vanishes. So that was a huge challenge for me. And in the end, it took 15 years. And thank you for your patience. That's entirely my fault. But I will very gladly spin it into a few positives here tonight. And there were three benefits I can think of for taking so long. One is all of those Freedom of Information Act requests came through. That was a benefit. But the second and more substantive is that I was able to grab people over time. So sometimes, every time I visited Tirana, another party was in power. Well, it's always two parties, but one or the other. And so at that moment, I could grab the people who were in opposition. And of course, they were more willing to speak, took time, definitely had time, and could give me their perspective. And secondly was to watch the transition or watch people's positions evolve over time. And you know, here there's something strong to be said because people's positions changed a great deal, not because the issue changed, but they were positioning themselves around that issue. And the most classic example I can think of is all of the people who turned around and criticized the main political actor of this era, Salih Berisha, the former president and prime minister, criticized him after they had been expelled from the party. You know, so all of a sudden they discovered democratic values, or all of a sudden they realized that maybe Berisha was not the great Democrat that they themselves had claimed him to be when they were a minister or otherwise a senior party official. And it's, you know, for those of you who do read this book, there's a number of characters who have gone back and forth over time, mostly based on opportunism. That's an important comment, I think, about the transition. Foreigners were not immune. And the best example I can think of this are the pyramid schemes. So in 1997, Albania suffered the collapse of massive pyramid schemes and pushed the country into chaos and real violence. And, you know, it's pretty easy to dismiss the pyramid schemes today. But there were a lot of people who stayed silent about those schemes. I'm talking about foreigners. There are foreigners and diplomats in Tirana, serving in Tirana, who did not speak a word about these pyramid schemes, although it was clear what they were. There were foreigners who invested in these pyramid schemes as well. So, you know, again, it's easy to look back afterwards and comment on it. Henry is in the house. So that was the benefit of time. And the third thing is, we're at 25 years. It's been 1990 since this process began in Albania. And the transition is not finished, but we are, I believe, at the end of the first phase. So it is a good moment to stop and look back and analyze, critique, you know, what took place. So that's my spin for taking so long. With that said, I wanted to just mention three takeaways, if I could call it that, or conclusions. One is that Albania didn't have a revolution. I think that's not so shocking to most Albanians, but maybe to others who haven't followed. There wasn't a revolution. What there was a series of gradual reforms, mostly from above. The communist leader at that time, the man who succeeded Enver Hoxha, is called Ramiz Aliyev. And Ramiz Aliyev understood very well that Albania couldn't stand alone in Eastern Europe after the fall of communism and the Soviet bloc, and he had to change. His safety and the safety of his cohorts required that. So he began. You know, it was a sort of Gorbachev model to initiate reform. And to do it, he looked to the trusted intellectuals and elites of Tirana, mostly, but of the country. And the best phrase to capture this strategy came from one of Aliyev's, probably his most senior behind-the-scenes advisor, which is a guy named Sophocles Lazary. And Lazary, I got to interview him before he passed away. And he called it the transfer of influence. Not the transfer of power, but the transfer of influence, that Aliyev identified senior officials who were connected to the party and transferred his influence to them. And some were party members, and others were just in the warm embrace of the party, if not being formally members, and they were trusted. And what Aliyev feared the most were the rabble-rousers in places like Shkodër, Kavaya. There were little protests popping up, mostly frustrated young men who wanted to travel abroad and wear jeans and listen to Western music, and he feared them because that was an uncontrollable force. But the elite could be very well controlled. So we had this sort of managed transition. And I have to say that in the end of the day, maybe that wasn't such a bad thing. Because if you think how extreme, violent, and repressive Albania was for four decades, a rupture could have been very bloody. So this sort of reform instead of rupture quite possibly saved a lot of lives. It brought problems without a clean break, but it's possible it also saved lives. The second takeaway is the creation, although there was no revolution, the creation of a revolution myth. And that meant that right after the communist regime fell, the new party came to power, it was the Democratic Party, almost immediately there were good guys and bad guys. They all came from the same mass, the same society, but all of a sudden some of them were enlightened Democrats, and some of them were recalcitrant communists, which is a completely artificial division, you know, because there were people who joined the Communist Party. They renamed themselves the Socialist Party, joined the Socialist Party after 92, so new members. And there were lots of people, Sali Berisha among them, and other Democratic Party founders, not just Berisha, Gramos Pashko, and many others, who were party members and then founded the Democratic Party. So there was a crossover. There was a crossover and an artificial division between blue and red, good and bad, old and new. I understand why that why the Albanians did that. And the new party in power played the revolution myth for their own political support. But what shocked me was how the international community bought into that game. And not just bought into it, but fed it. And that includes the U.S. government. And the U.S. government, well, first and foremost, the U.S. government, who viewed Sali Berisha, and again, it's not just about him, but viewed them at the party as the force of future, the force for the future, and the force for good. And, you know, to me, that has caused problems that Albania are still suffering from today. If you look at the cables, some of the diplomatic cables that I got from the Freedom of Information Act, you see it. You know, you see the ambassador in 92 and 93 writing that, well, these are just the games of the former communists. Well, you know, who are these people? I mean, how can you label one group that title? They were certainly playing games. I'm not defending what they did, but to label them as such was, to me, feeding into this artificial division. And the clearest manifestation of this is Berisha. You know, he became the hero of democracy, the Democrat with a big D. And the problem is, my feeling was, you know, it's not about having supported the Democratic Party fully and having supported Sali Berisha with enthusiasm. Berisha was by far the most talented politician of that era, by far. And I get why he led the movement, became the party head, became the first post-communist president, earned support from Washington and European capitals. I get it. But the problem was not supporting him, it was supporting him uncritically. So when Berisha harassed a journalist, silence. When he arrested a journalist, silence. When he arrested an opposition member or beat up an opposition member, not himself, silence. And, you know, those were all interpreted as green light. Every time it wasn't challenged, he was able to take it a step further. And the issue was the failure or the mistake of U.S. policy, I'll say specifically, but the Europeans were no different on this, is it fed into Albania's political tradition of dominance and revenge. And it supported an individual or that party over the institutions. And that's what Albania is still suffering from today. You know, I think a lot of the people I interviewed, some of these individuals who played roles back then, the ambassador I mentioned, some other diplomats who were very involved at that time. And some of them defended it by saying, well, you know, this is Albania was coming from the darkest past, and bumps are expected. No, BS. I call BS on that. I don't believe it. I don't buy it. Because, you know, yes, we're not going to expect an immediate jump. We're not going to expect institutions, independent institutions, to be created overnight. But they could have spoken out. It would have made a difference. And those moves I mentioned, the harassment of the journalist, the arrest of the journalist, and so on, those were calculated moves. They were even, I think, testing the water, if it wasn't maybe so premeditated. That's, in effect, how it played out. And in the end of the day, they could have still supported Berisha and the Democratic Party at that time and drawn some lines in the sand. The third thing, and I'm going to end here, is why. You know, why did that happen? And I think there are a couple of reasons. One is actually that Washington didn't know Albania very well at that time. There's a great anecdote when diplomatic relations were reestablished in 1991 between Washington and between Albania and the United States. They had a ceremony in the State Department. They didn't have a flag. They didn't have an Albanian flag. And someone had to run home, and they had gotten it as a gift and managed to put it on the table. Okay, that tells you the extent of the relationship back in 1991. So in some ways, they just didn't know. They didn't know the players. They didn't know the country. The second is that I think a lot of diplomats just got carried away. And I'll admit, it was an emotional story. You know, the best example was the visit in June 1991 of Secretary of State James Baker. Came to Tirana, and they literally tried to carry his limousine or his car in from the airport. Literally, all right? The Secret Service had nightmares. And he was greeted in Skanderbeg Square, the main square of Tirana, by hundreds of thousands of people. And, you know, that enthusiasm is contagious. But it also ended up, I think, warping policy. You know, because they viewed Albania incredibly pro-American, thinking that this was the force to accept uncritically, and the third and then there's also this mistaken belief, and I hope this comes through in the book a little bit, that democracy means free elections and market economy, a very naive belief, and Albania had both. I mean, had free elections and had, I would say, what's that? Well, in the beginning, 92, I'm thinking, 92, later, no, and market reform. And clearly, that wasn't enough. But the main reason, and I'm going to wrap it up here, a key factor in this was the region. And just to bring this a little bit wider. And you have to remember the context at the time, that 1990, 91, 92, we're looking at the disintegration of ex-Yugoslavia. We're looking at serious tension in neighboring Kosovo and Macedonia, which have large ethnic Albanian populations. And the U.S. government was concerned, and I believe rightly concerned, about avoiding an Albanian nationalist movement. They didn't want nationalism to replace communism. They did not want a spread of this war. They wanted to contain it. And they saw Berisha and the Democratic Party as a force for that. And in effect, there was a Faustian deal was struck, where in essence, he was allowed to rule and do what he wanted inside Albania, but was not allowed to mess around outside his borders. And, you know, I get the regional approach. That's a logical attitude, but I think they could have drawn those lines and still gotten what they wanted, still managed to keep the regional issue under control. And in the end, it failed, and it failed miserably, because the 1997 pyramid schemes that I mentioned, those were not an economic debacle or an economic scandal. They were, in essence, economic Ponzi schemes, but it was political. It was a political deceit, because everybody knew the government was supporting those pyramid schemes. It was like the FDIC, you know, kind of insurance, like a state insurance. When you advertise a pyramid scheme on the state television, that is an endorsement. So it was a result of this pent-up frustration, economic loss, but also political, and it had a direct impact on the political stability that they were trying to maintain. Because when the schemes melted away and the depots were looted and Albanian arms in the hundreds of thousands were distributed across the country, then those arms ended up across the border in Kosovo. And the nascent Kosovo Liberation Army saw it as a historic opportunity. That's a quote, actually, from the book. We would miss a historical opportunity if we didn't go there and scoop up arms, which is exactly what they did. So in the goal of regional stability, in the end, was harmed very greatly. So I think that's all I wrote. Arye, what do you think?
Okay, well, I think I'd like to ask you a few questions and then open it up generally. But I'm going to start from the standpoint of someone who went to Albania, and I think I went either in late 1993 or early 1994 for the first time. In going there, I remember feeling, I didn't know much about the country, but I remember feeling extremely skeptical about the possibility that one could develop a democracy in Albania or develop an open society in Albania, because it had been the most isolated country in Europe, one of the most isolated countries in the world. Only North Korea seemed comparable in the degree to which it had been cut off from the rest of the world. A country of where there had been extreme repression. No civil society had existed during the communist regime. How could one build a democracy or an open society when there was so little that one could build upon? If you thought of other communist countries in Europe, if you thought of Poland, for example, a substantial civil society had developed in Poland during the communist era. When Solidarity was crushed, an underground Solidarity movement emerged, which, among other things, published literally hundreds of underground periodicals. And that seemed to give the basis for trying to promote and... Am I not getting this on?
You want to try this one?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, that seemed to provide the basis for building an open society. Your book is From Dictatorship to Democracy in Europe. Do you think we've accomplished this goal of building a democracy? Is it a democracy today?
Does anyone want to take that? Sorry. That's a good word. Emerging, says Alma. I don't think I can answer that yes or no. Anyone who knows has been in Albania, certainly grew up during communism or was there in the early transition years, know that the place is far more livable today than it was before. That there's no question about that. And even at times quite decent. But is it a democratic country? I would have a hard time using that adjective. Is it more democratic today than it was before? Yeah, you know, there's no question about that. And for me, I guess the issue is not so much, is it better or worse? You're not asking that, are you? But, is it as good as it could be? The measure of success isn't necessarily where people are at the top, but where they are as a whole. And in that case, there's deep divisions in that society. Economic, of course. I mean, just flat out poverty rates that are unacceptably high. Not to mention all kinds of health indicators that are well below European standards or what should be normal standards. So in that sense, there's a long way to go. And for me, I guess, just to come back to that, individuals over institutions, that to me, institutions, let's just be clear, it means, independent courts, it means police that just serve the law and not an interest. It means a media that's free and independent, going to actually probe and report. And none of those three things are institutions are very strong in Albania today. It doesn't leave citizens with sort of honest arbiters of disputes, and those disputes are many. There's many layers of disputes going back, Lord knows how many generations. So in that sense, maybe don't know if I've answered the question, but
Thank you. Let me then ask you about a passage in your book, which I found somewhat surprising. You're writing about the period at the end of the pyramid scheme collapse, and you have this paragraph. You say, above all, I viewed 1997, which is the period of the pyramid scheme collapse, not as a crisis in the country, but a crisis of the country. Albania had an entry in the Atlas, a national hymn, and a flag. It sat in the United Nations, but the country lacked a collective identity to hold it together. What do you mean by that, that it lacked a collective identity? I would have thought it did have a collective identity.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a collective identity in the notion of flags and songs and hymns and all the rest. But the result of 4 decades of enforced totalitarianism was extreme individualism. And the best example is the physical ripping apart in 1991 and 92 of the of community centers and schools and any state structure, where people literally ripped out the windows and the electric wires and the electricity plugs and plundered these institutions because, well, if they didn't do it, the person next door would. And that's a reaction. That's a reaction to the enforced collectivization, violently enforced collectivization. But it meant democracy for them at that time. Democracy meant the right to do whatever you want. And that's what I meant by the collective identity. And that means that, you know, there are interests that dominate politics and society. You know, I mean, business interests, economic interests, political interests. And they have not yet... there's room to go to have a national interest, where we say, you know, we need a monetary policy and a health policy and an education policy that's in our common good. If I may, just one other example of that is the environment. You know, anyone who's been to Albania in 1990-91, the beach in Durrës was paradise. I mean, you know, beautiful beach, pristine. I remember these wonderful pine trees. You could sit in the shade. By 92, 93, there was garbage everywhere, you know, because people didn't care. They didn't think about, you know, if I toss my garbage, it's going to affect my neighbor. It's that simple. And I think that's changed, where now there is discussion about national policy for tourism or you know, developing the natural resources of a country. These normal conversations that states have is when states are communities. And the country, in my view, is heading more in that direction. But a lot of this period was dominated by that, by the lack of community.
And then a question based on my own experience going to Albania in the 1990s. The reason that I went to Albania quite a lot during that period is that the Open Society Foundations undertook a particularly large project in Albania. Fred just mentioned the way that buildings were vandalized at the time of the end of the communist rule of the country, and among other things, the schools were vandalized during that period. And we wanted to launch an education project in Albania. We focused on an education project because we thought this country has had such a deep, such deep totalitarian rule that it's going to take a long time to build a democracy or an open society, and that what we have to do is invest in the long term of the country. And so focusing on the primary schools and to a lesser extent on the secondary schools would be the way for us to try to shape the country for the long term. And at one stage, the education project was the largest single project we undertook in the foundations worldwide. We spent, I don't know how much, but more than $25 million on the education project in Albania. And I can remember a budget for a particular year in which the education project just in that year's budget cost more than $8 million. But we couldn't deal with education the way we did in other countries where we supported teacher training, we supported the publication of new textbooks, matters of that sort, because the schools had been destroyed in the aftermath of the communist period, and we don't ordinarily undertake construction projects anywhere in the world. But we felt we had to do it in Albania. We had to physically rehabilitate the schools, and so we did that with more than 150 schools in the country, and we also organized parent-teacher associations and undertook the sort of teacher training programs and the textbook publication, which we thought was necessary. In a way, that turned out to be an extremely satisfying project, and the particularly satisfying aspect of it was that after the pyramid, or when the pyramid schemes collapsed, there was again a period of vandalism of that sort in Albania, and again public buildings were trashed by people who were extremely angry about the loss of all their savings in the collapse of the pyramid schools. But what made us quite happy about our own experience was that none of the schools that we had rehabilitated was trashed. What we thought made the difference is that one of the people working on the project, an engineer of part Kosovar, part Bosnian background, who had also played an important role for us in Sarajevo during the siege there, and who we had relocated to Albania, had insisted on enlisting local people on a volunteer basis to help reconstruct the schools and also to donate something to the schools. So in a number of cases, local people who had very little in the way of resources donated the gravel that surrounded the school. And we thought that because those people had put their own labor into the schools and their own resources into the schools, they insisted on preserving them against the vandalism. And there were cases in which the people who did that came out at night and guarded the schools to make sure that nobody else would vandalize them. It seemed to be a kind of object lesson in the way that if you could enlist people to feel a stake in rebuilding the country, that they would do important things, that they would do good things for the country. So that particular experience was especially satisfying in dealing with the schools project. But you know, a larger question is, were we making the right choice? If we were going to spend that kind of money on Albania, should we have focused on educating children who weren't going to be active in doing anything about the country for another 20, 25, 30 years? Should we have focused larger resources on shorter term efforts to have an impact on the country rather than think that because of that sad history of the country, we really ought to concentrate on long-term efforts?
Yeah. I mean, I certainly, you know, I it's hard to analyze what would be the most effective use of such an investment, but I would say that long-term approach to me is the way to go, because it returns to the notion of institutions and education, you know, being one of them, not an independent political institution, but certainly you know, building up for the longer term capacity of the country. And you know, I think just to return to use the anecdote that you gave, you know, I that's about ownership to me. People didn't loot those schools because they felt they had a piece in it. Piece of it, and it was you know, serving their interests. And maybe that's a good way to understand the transition, or we can use that as a lens a little bit, that, you know, during communism in Albania, they viewed the state as not serving their interests at all, and they had no participation in the state. And today, I think people have much more participation in the state, not just through this example, but in general. They might not loot any schools, you know, even not ones that they had personally been involved in. They feel more able to influence policymakers and decision makers, but nowhere near enough, because, in my view, many people still feel that decisions are made. Whether in education or in the economy and so on, without consideration for their well-being. But it's an interesting way to analyze the transition, maybe a bit abstract, but how people feel, how much they feel like they can contribute or influence their government.
Okay, let me open it up to others right now. There's a microphone standing over there, and Becca has a microphone on this side. So we have a man here in the front, in the third row, right there.
All right. My name is Roberto Toscana. I'm a retired Italian diplomat. From everything that was said, I think that two concepts stand out, although they were not mentioned explicitly. Concepts that identify the basic deficits of the Albanian system today. One is rule of law, and the second one is the citizen. But if you don't have the rule of law, and if you don't have the citizen, if you, Fred, were the advisor to the present Albanian government, or to Albanian Democrats who do exist, what would you say? How to go about it? Because organizing an election is definitely not enough. And secondly, you know, blaming communism reminds me of I was in the Soviet Union in the 70s, and they were still blaming the Tsar for all their shortcomings. It's about time to leave that aside.
Yeah. Should we take a few, or maybe?
Okay, let's take a couple. Let's take a couple of other questions, and then Fred will respond.
Mm. Only with difficulty. Ian Williams, I was at the time with the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, which I think was one of your projects. And I was in the Balkans. But Fred, having read your book assiduously, one of the things is the dog that didn't bark. Where were the military in all of this? This is one of the most militarized societies in the world. Mm-hmm. And yet the armed forces played very little part in the transition, mm-hmm. except, I suppose, in a sort of positively negative way, they stepped aside and let things happen. So it's just only since reading the book that's, you know, in Romania, Poland, Yugoslavia, the military played a prominent role in the changes,
right.
Not positive necessarily, but in Albania they just seem to have disappeared. What happened?
Okay, so we've got the military and the law. one more question, and then Fred will respond.
Hi, my name is Kitty Kayan. I actually work here at OSF. I grew up in Albania. I moved in 97, so I had, I guess, the privilege of growing up through those years. Just a comment. I think I was fascinated about the discussion around community and citizenship, and I think there's lots of negative points there, but at the same time, we are a country of a deep sense of community, and it can be demonstrated by sheltering of the Kosovo refugees, by sheltering even the, all the Jews that escaped during Nazi times, and no one was killed in Albania. So I think there's this great sense of community that somehow is maybe hidden around around the margins of this discussion. And yeah, maybe a lot of the mistrust that was created during communism by the Secret Service, etc., where you never trusted your neighbors, etc., and underlied with the big poverty and extreme poverty in this time, did create a lot of looting, and that lingered for many years. But there's still a lot, a very strong sense of community that can be felt by Albanians all around. So maybe highlight some of those points as well.
Okay, I think you've got a rich...
more than rich, yeah. I mean, you know, on that, I feel a little bit sometimes Albanians are nicer to outsiders than they are to each other. You know, seriously, some of the divisions are very, very harsh. But of course, I mean, you know, there's... I don't want to take it to the extreme where there's, you know, very powerful and moving examples of strong community. There's, you know, no intent here to suggest that doesn't exist. Far from it. On the military, it's a great question, and the answer is it's a great question because the answer is simple, and I know it. Which is that the military was subservient to the party. There was never an independent military in Albania. Enver Hoxha made that absolutely, clear. The best phrase to explain this was that you were swept away with an iron broom, which is how he purged a number of officers that he thought were getting a little too uppity. And so the military was always subservient. Even the Sigurimi, the intelligence agency, the feared, even the Sigurimi was subservient to the party. Tani, am I right? My historian friend agrees. That's how this book was written. Am I right, Artan? Am I right? Am I right? So there was never... The one section was cut out of the book just for space. The publisher wanted to trim it down. There was an attempted coup. When Enver Hoxha's monument fell in February of 91, the day after, a group of officers and military cadets tried to basically put it back. You know, they wanted to reinstall the monument. And then they were furious that the leadership had allowed this mob to topple the statue of the great leader. And they did mobilize and hold up in one of the, not a barracks, but I think it was the school, the officers training academy in Tirana, and tried. And it quickly fizzled out. So that, you know, it was a very weak attempt. And that's because the military just didn't have that capacity. And the third question is, you know, rule of law. I mean, I didn't use those three words, but that is what I was talking about this entire time. I mean, having independent courts and, you know, when a crime is committed, then someone is punished based on the law, not because of who they know or who they pay. That happens more today than it did in the past, but very often it doesn't happen. And someone asked me, when is Albania going to join the European Union, or how are the prospects for Albania joining the European Union, which they want to? And my answer is pretty simple. Albania will join the European Union, and it deserves to join the European Union, when a senior government official, minister and above, is put in prison for a serious crime. I mean, corruption, mostly, right? And it's not about putting aside any single individual. But when the court systems are strong enough to say, no, you broke the law, and it doesn't matter what position you hold, then they've reached a level where I say, well, the courts have, you know, and they deserve... that integration. So.
If I could also respond briefly to the rule of law question, I can tell you that in 20 years or so that I spent as president of this foundation, one of the things I found most difficult was to find ways to promote the rule of law through external efforts to transform the system within a country. That is, you couldn't say, you know, replace all the judges. That itself would be a political act, and who were you going to put in their place as the judges? It would be extremely difficult to deal with something like that. You almost had to approach rule of law issues on a bottom-up basis. George Soros has a sort of favorite story that I will steal from him. He tells about a visit to Georgia, the country, not the state, and that he had made a speech and he had talked about corruption in the judiciary. And after that, he got a letter from one of the judges. And the judge said he was very taken with George Soros's remarks. And he said that they would have a big influence on him. But he said there was a difficulty. And that is that he was required to pay a portion of the bribes he received to the appellate judges who would review his decisions. And could George give him a grant to cover the bribes that he would have to pay to the appellate judges? And it does seem to me indicative of the difficulty of for an external actor in trying to cope with the problem of the rule of law.
Thank you. Thank you for your talk, and I look forward to reading the book. I haven't read it as yet. I'm a former director of the UN mission in Kosovo, your neighbor, and our issues with respect to rule of law development and institutional development in general were slightly different because of the ethnic factors. But what I wanted to know from you, seeing that our country isn't exactly a model these days of rule of law, I've not seen anybody go to jail for the mortgage crisis. How, as an American, writing this book, did you get challenged by, you know, the knowledge that you have of your country and how it may or may not apply to democratization in Albania? Democratization is a very long process. We're still dealing with it 200 years later. I think they can be forgiven for many of their growing pains, but how did you navigate those questions that must have come up?
Avni?
Thank you. I'm Avni Mustafa. I was also at the Soros Foundation with Fred and Franz. So, Fred, thank you very much and congratulations. In answer to your question, Ari, it was 94 that you first came to Albania.
Okay, thank you.
Fred, my question is that, you know, you were there very early on when we saw really there was nothing going on. And you know, from my standpoint, I always begin with the notion that it was the isolation, the poverty that impacted everything. I mean, Albanian culture has a sway, but if you look at how the Albanians in Albania and Kosovo and Montenegro have come out from the old system to the new system, I think they were a little bit more prepared. But I think the isolation in Albania, because not only were Albanians isolated from the rest of the world, but they were isolated within Albania. So I think that when they attack the schools and when they attack everything, it was because they owned nothing. I mean, even a barber, even the scissors that he owned were owned by the state. So if you think of the way society was struck, not only were people not allowed to associate from having a god, you know, from that notion. So my question to you is, having gone through this process now for so many years, what strikes you the most? What has been the biggest surprise from you, given that you were there so early on and where we are today? In the book.
Okay. Do you you want to take one more question? Or,
sure, we can do one more. Yeah.
Okay, let's get one more over here.
Thank you. My name is Jesse Hawks, and I'm from Global Youth Connect. We have programs in Bosnia and Rwanda, so I really know very little about Albania. I was curious to know a little bit more about how active are youth today in Albania, and to what extent are they active in political mobilization and social change efforts, and does social media play a role in this as well? And mm-hmm. curious about any thoughts on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. Well, first, I'm being challenged as an American. Look, you know, I've been all around the world for Human Rights Watch, and I get that question every single time. What about Guantanamo? Well, what about Iraq? I mean, that, but not in Albania. No, the sort of, you know, they still don't carry people's cars in from the airport, but the... they're all here in New York. But the pro-Americanism is still, you know, very, very strong. And so and it didn't come up once. I mean, no one ever turned around and said, you know, how can you be asking these questions when there's, you know, this and that problem? Yeah? No, I'm not saying it's anti-Americanism, but I never had it. Yeah. I mean, the youth, I mean, other people are better situated. Becca probably could answer this question more. She's, you know, running projects in Albania, Avni certainly as well. I mean, definitely there's, you know, very dynamic youth movement. I mean, the age, I don't know the demographics, right? But, it, you know, the percentage of people under 30 or under 25 is very, very high, also in Kosovo. So, you know, there's a lot going on. Certainly social media is growing and, you know, plays a role. One of the major youth movements, the most influential youth movement of this period was a group called Mjaft, which means enough. They have the senior leadership of that group has all gone into politics. So, you know, in that sense, Mjaft still exists, I think, but is not as prominent as it was before. Avni, that's a tough question. What surprised me? I think part of it I said already. It was an eye-opening experience. I mean, to see how U.S. policy was formulated on Albania was for me, you know, an experience, an education, well beyond anything I got in my university. Because, you know, I was in Albania in 93 and 94 and saw this stuff up close and came back to New York and in Washington, and, you know, everyone was still praising Albania as this shining star of the East economically, even though pyramid schemes were beginning to grow at that time, and politically. And I was stunned. It's not that I had any great analysis. It was clear, you know, what was happening on the ground. And then, you know, just as an aside, now it seems obvious and probably clear to everybody here, but I got to know, you know, how U.S. policy, how there are competing institutions within the U.S. government. So, you know, State Department had one line. In Albania, in particular, you know, there were some individuals, and then it spread to institutions that took different views, and there was a competition within those institutions about what line would hold. So, you know, all of that was, for me, a huge, you know, an amazing thing.
Congressional caucus on Albania.
Still is, that's right. Yeah, Elliot Engel is the head of the Albanian caucus. And they played a role as well. You know, that for me, yeah, that was my education in terms of politics and international relations. You know, I guess regarding, you know, Albania itself, I mean, there's a tendency in a lot of writing, I mean, especially foreigners, to head in one of two directions. You know, either they mock, and mock is too strong, I don't mean to make fun of, but there's this distanced amusement with this quirky country. Or they glorify. And I wanted to avoid those two extremes and follow some middle path where, yeah, we can appreciate, acknowledge and appreciate the quirky and at times bizarre characters and events, but also explain it. You know, why is it so quirky? You know, what's the reason? It's not it's not genetic, you know. That's what I tried. I guess I don't know if I'm answering your question, but the reason I go to it is because I didn't want to, I just wanted to explain it. I don't know. Was that a surprise or not? But that's my answer, and I'm sticking to it.
Okay, so let's take one more round of questions in the back over
there. Hi, my name is Ingrid, and I'm part of the Albania Roots. We do the parade every year. And one thing that I wanted to say is I came here when I was 16, and I've been in a lot of places in Europe. And I think one thing that I realized why we have these problems in Albania is because our parents or grandparents taught us that we are communists. We're sticking on that. And we stuck on that idea that just because we're communists, we're voting for them, regardless who is in power, or regardless what they do. And I think a lot of people here in the United States have more education on that. Like, it's not about communists or Democrats, it's about what those people do for us. But people in Albania still on that little box that whatever parents did, we're doing it. So unless they get out of that box, it's going to still go on, and they'll always do the same thing. And I think that we who are here, like outside the United States, are more educated. And if someone from here goes there and do something, I think we can progress in a big time. I don't know, maybe it's just my opinion, and I'm young. I don't know much about politics. But I think we here, the young generation, are more open-minded, and we do more things. We have a lot of organization here that I know, and we do a lot of things. If we can take all those things and go back there, I think we can do wonders.
Over here in the center.
My name is Charles Walsh. I was, I'm a retired diplomat, American, not Italian. First of all, I'd like to say that Kindle tells me that I've read 5% of your book. And I wanted to say that based on the majority of your book that I'm familiar with, it's a great book. And it deserves to be up there with The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich and some of the books I mentioned to you earlier, Tropical Gangsters, and because it depicts a country and a process in a just beautiful way. I was there for just a few of those years, but it really nails it, the part that I was there. And my question is, when is this going to be translated into Albanian? And the second question is, I think, based on years at the OSCE and working in, you know, Belarus and Turkmenistan and all the other countries out there, that there are a lot of countries that can learn from the template that you describe in this process of moving from a totalitarian regime to what we have now. So is there a thought that OSI would support translation of this book into some of the other languages?
I did not plant that question.
No, he did not.
Oh. All right.
Okay, let's get one more over here. Two more, all right.
All right.
We'll get two more questions.
So I guess we're here 25 years later, and my question, I suppose, is for both of you. What would you describe the legacy of the foundation in Albania, I think? What would you describe the legacy of the foundation in Albania these 25 years? That figure you cited was astonishing. I'm still sort of reeling back from it. And I think a lot of what you described, Fred, in your remarks could have probably been the subtitle of the book, is the influence of foreign interests in Albania and how they shaped modern Albania. So I guess maybe some of that legacy.
Okay.
Was there one more?
Yes, one more over there on the side.
Thank you.
Who's talking?
I have a rather boring question. Okay. Uh-huh. And I love definitions. I Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Mirela Gekbrifti. Back to my boring question. I love definitions, and I would love to hear your definition of the very title of it, and I haven't read the book, Modern Albania, which is so lovely, and I would love to hear what that means, and how was Albania when wasn't modern, or is it modern yet? And I get the picture of the looters, and by the way, you know, there were looters all over, you know, the Katrina episode here in the States. So anyway, that's a different question. And okay. So definitions. I would love to hear a little bit on that. Thank you.
Should I go?
Sure.
No? Mirela, it's good to see you, first of all. Thank you for that question. I really wish I had a deep answer for you. The crates of wine and beer that Fran and Artan and I went through trying to come up with a title would fill this room. And in the end, this was chosen in consultation with NYU Press. Without deep vision, so I'm sorry to disappoint you. It's sort of the country today. We actually had a discussion, how would we translate this into Albanian? Because Shqipëria Moderna is not quite right. Maybe we can talk about that in the I thought Shqipëria Sot, which also plays on a nice Tirana story. But in any case, I wanted to come to your question. I thought that was very beautiful, what you said, and I agree. There's a real contribution for young people in general, but especially those who have, you know, been educated and grown up abroad to make. And it's true. Many people vote for the party because it's what they've always done. And the amazing thing, I said this before, you know, the political class, they all came from the same tree. And if you look at the policies, the policy differences between the parties is almost non-recognizable. You know, this is not about policy, you know. And so it's about individuals and interests. And that's why people keep voting for the same party, because they know that if they do, they'll keep their job. So, it's an emotional thing, a personal thing, but it's also a practical thing, right? What was the last question? Charles.
And also the legacy.
The legacy. I was going to leave that to last so we can both. First of all, one of the diplomats, and it's amazing to say, one of the few, not the only one, who got it when Charles was in Albania, and in a difficult time, 95, 96, 97 especially, got, and is in the book, by the way, as are a few other people here too, because I saw Stacey Sullivan sneak in the back. Yes, it's being translated. We have an Albanian publisher. And will come out hopefully in the fall. And I couldn't be more excited about that. You know, we were discussing it before. Has there been a reaction in Albania yet? And not yet, because it's still, this is the launch. If there isn't a reaction, I'll be deeply, deeply disappointed. And I don't mean embracing the book, far from it. You know, I mean, I hope that there is fierce and thoughtful criticism, as long as it's thoughtful, that it stirs up a conversation. I mean, that's the point. That is the point. That's the mirror that I referenced before. So I sure hope that it inspires that, provokes that. The legacy.
I'm out of date in terms of my own visits to Albania, so I really have to respond to that. More in terms of the general standard for the legacy one tries to achieve in any country, and that is part of the legacy is in individuals, and part of the legacy is in institutions. The individuals are those who may benefit from the educational programs that we have supported, and the educational programs have included the programs, as I mentioned, at the primary and secondary school level, but they've also included substantial scholarship programs over the years at the university level. They also include the people who may have benefited from the book publishing programs that we supported and were able to read books in Albanian that they could not have obtained in any other fashion. Helping to have an effect on those individuals through programs of that sort is important. And then as far as institutions are concerned, institutions can include the newspapers or the press that we have helped to make possible within the country, the civil society organizations that exist within the country, which have primarily been supported by the foundation, and a range of other institutions in the country that have benefited from the work of the foundation over the course of the years. The theory is that if you're going to have an open society, you need to have the citizenry that is educated and engaged, and the programs of the foundation contribute to both education and engagement, and you have to have diverse and credible institutions within the country which can have an effect upon the way in which the country develops. We can't introduce democracy into Albania. We can't introduce the rule of law into Albania. There are a lot of things we can't do, but the individuals and the civil society actors may be able to do that, and by empowering people in that fashion, our hope is that they will help to create an open society within the country.
Yeah, maybe I'll just say one word on that. I mean, I always thought OSI's role and other foundations and institutions work, it's incredibly challenging to work in Albania. I mean, and there's this real balance. You know, how do you move a tree? You know, you can take a shovel and move a little dirt, sort of the long-term programs Arye was referencing. Maybe you can hack off a limb or uproot, you know, a tree. And where do you challenge or where do you accommodate a system where the change is going to be long term? So I always thought that was incredibly difficult. On the one hand, there are the list of projects that wouldn't have happened in Albania without outside support from foundations such as this one. Well, the list is very, very long. How many students went abroad, how many papers were supported, how many Columbia grad students got to go to Albania. The list is endless, right? But, you know, at the same time, if we stop and say, have we succeeded? You know, well, I think we should be honest and say we're far, far from where we, you know, want to be, we in the abstract collective sense. There's more to be done. Maybe that's the best way to put it.
Thank you. Thank you, Arye. Thank you, Fred. I know that many of you bought the book, and I know that Fred will be very glad to sign the book here, but there are some more books out there for those who have not bought, and please join us for a glass of wine to celebrate the book launch. Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.